of the day. 9 times out of 10, the most obvious one is some sin against charity. I have sulked, or snapped, or sneered, or snubbed, or stormed. And the excuse that immediately springs to mind is that the provocation was so sudden or unexpected, I was caught off my guard. I had not time to collect myself. Surely what a man does when he is taken off guard is the best evidence for what sort of man he is. Surely what pops out before the man has time to put on a disguise is the truth. If there are rats in the cellar, you are most likely to see them if you go in very suddenly. But the suddenness does not create the rats. It only prevents them from hiding. In the same way, the suddenness of the provocation does not make me an ill-tempered man. It only shows me what an ill-tempered man I am. Now that cellar is out of reach of my conscious will. I cannot, by direct moral effort, give myself new motives. After the first few steps, we realize that everything which really needs to be done in our souls can be done only by God. Close quote. New heading, a final word on trust. Much of my focus in this chapter on building trust has been on things we can consciously do to build relationships of trust with others. On creating trust, the noun. But remember, trust is also a verb. I started part two of this book with the story of how early in my adult life, someone saw potential within me that far exceeded what I saw in myself. He saw beneath the surface, beyond the obvious and evident. He looked into my heart and eyes and spirit and saw the raw, undeveloped, unseen seeds of greatness that lie within each one of us. So he entrusted me with a charge and responsibility far beyond my experience and perceived ability. He gave me this trust without evidence, without proof. He simply believed and expected that I would rise to the challenge, and he treated me accordingly. It was an act of faith. But that act of faith so affirmed my worth and potential that I was inspired to see it in myself. His faith in me increased my own faith and vision of myself. I aspired to the highest and most noble inclinations within me. I was not perfect, but how I grew. It also became a philosophy of life to me. Affirm people. Affirm your children. Believe in them, not in what you see, but in what you don't see, their potential. True and profound are the words of the poet Goethe, who said, "Treat a man as he is, and he will remain as he is. Treat a man as he can and should be, and he will become as he can and should be." Close quote. In short, trust becomes a verb when you communicate to others their worth and potential so clearly that they are inspired to see it in themselves. Trust is not only the fruit of trustworthiness, it is also the root of motivation. It is the highest form of motivation. Love also becomes a verb. It is something you do. You love or serve others. You trust others. You see their worth and potential and provide opportunity and nourishment and encouragement. If they do not live true to this trust, it will deteriorate and they will not be inspired to see their own worth and potential. Then they won't have the ability to communicate to others their worth and potential. To them, trust will not be a verb. In fact, it will be very hard for an untrustworthy person to trust anybody or to believe in anybody in a sustainable way. Allow me to illustrate with a story I share often how love, like trust, can become a verb. At one seminar where I was speaking, a man came up and said, "Stephen, I like what you're saying, but every situation is so different. I mean, look at my marriage. I'm really worried. My wife and I just don't have the same feelings for each other we used to have. I guess I just don't love her anymore, and she doesn't love me. What can I do?" "The feelings aren't there anymore," I asked. "That's right," he reaffirmed. "And we have 3 children that we're really concerned about. What do you suggest?" "Love her," I replied. "I told you the feeling just isn't there anymore." "Then love her." "You don't understand. The feeling of love just isn't there." "Then love her. If the feeling isn't there, that's a good reason to love her." "But how do you love when you don't love?" "My friend, Love is a verb. Love the feeling is a fruit of love the verb. So love her, sacrifice, listen to her, serve her, empathize, appreciate, affirm her. Are you willing to do that? In the great literature of all progressive societies, love is a verb. It's reactive people that make it a feeling. They're driven by feelings. Hollywood has generally scripted us to believe that we are not responsible, that love is a feeling. But our Hollywood script does not describe the reality. If our feelings control our actions, it is because we have abdicated our responsibility and empowered them to do so. Proactive people make love a verb. Love is something you do, the sacrifices you make, the giving of self like a mother bringing a newborn into the world. If you want to study love, study those who sacrifice for others, even for people who offend or do not love in return. If you are a parent, look at the love you have for the children you sacrifice for. Love is a value that is actualized through loving actions. Proactive people subordinate feelings to values. Love, the feeling, can be recaptured. Where is the very best place to give trust, to communicate people's worth and potential? Without any question, it's the family. If the family is dysfunctional, where is the next best place? The school. The teacher becomes like a surrogate parent who begins the trusting process again. Remember the power you hold to give your trust to others? You may open yourself to the risk of being disappointed, and you will need to be wise in the exercise of this power. But when you do, you give a priceless gift and opportunity to others. The greatest risk of all is the risk of riskless living. Now let's see a little film on this. This is the true story of Helen Keller and her teacher, Ann Sullivan. The film is titled Teacher. Helen Keller was deaf and blind. Ann Sullivan was legally blind herself and had a very neglectful and abusive childhood, but transcended it by finding meaning in serving one student, Helen Keller. The life and contributions of Helen Keller are truly inspiring, even amazing, and never-ending. Tens of millions of people have been directly or indirectly influenced by her. But the key to Helen Keller was her teacher, Ann Sullivan. As you watch this film found on the DVD in the book, study it through the lens of the two roads, the upper road to greatness and the lower road to mediocrity. Study how, through her choices, Ann Sullivan became a person of vision, discipline, passion governed by conscience, and the moral authority that developed within her through sacrifice and overcoming adversity. Study how Helen Keller became a balanced, integrated, powerful person after living in darkness from birth. Study how the relationship of trust between Ann and Helen was formed through constant deposits. Study the speedy, subtle communication that has enabled the patience, the persistence, the understanding, and the bonding that took place. In short, it is a beautiful story of two magnificent persons, great people, who found their own voices and devoted their lives to inspiring others to find theirs, breathing life into countless numbers throughout the world. Here are some common questions I am often asked on the subject of building trust. How do you improve attitude? There is nothing more cancerous to an organization than negative attitudes. How do you deal with that? Let me attempt an answer at three levels. First, at the personal level, be an example of one with a positive attitude, one who avoids the metastasizing cancers of complaining, criticizing, comparing, competing, and contending. Seriously, there is nothing more powerful than to be around a person who is a light, not a judge, who is a model, not a critic. Second, give a little personal one-on-one time to build a relationship with the person who seems to have a sour or negative attitude. Negative attitudes are really a symptom of deeper things going on. People need to feel understood. Seeking to understand another is so therapeutic, so healing and so affirming to them that oftentimes you end up working on the roots rather than just snipping about the lack of fruits. Third, sometimes there are other forces at play stronger than your example or your relationship with the person. Sometimes you simply have to smile and not obsess about it. This keeps the negativity cancer from metastasizing. Remember, when you build your emotional life on the weaknesses of others, including their negative attitudes, you disempower yourself and empower their negative attitudes to continue to metastasize their cancer cells through the culture. You can't change all things. You can't change people. You can only change yourself. However, I have found that sometimes if people can develop a skill or competency that is in alignment with the fundamental gift or talent that they have, their attitude toward themselves, toward others, and toward life significantly improves. For example, let's say you're trying to teach someone to play tennis. Would it be best to talk to them about their attitude if they seemed a little low or discouraged and negative? Would it be best to give them more knowledge about ground strokes and volleys? Or would it simply be best to get out there on the court, take the skill route, and have them literally practice the skills until they wanted more knowledge? You would then find their attitude naturally becoming more positive as they come to enjoy the game. There are these three routes to make improvements: knowledge, skill, and attitude. Most people focus on the attitude and knowledge routes. They're faster. They're more efficient. I suggest the key to those two is the skill route. People simply feel better about themselves and about life when they're good at something. Another question commonly asked: what is the best advice you've ever given as it relates to motivation? My answer would be, first be an example and a model, and then affirm the worth and potential of the other so clearly that he or she comes to see it in himself or herself, not just through your words, but also through aligned, reinforcing systems and incentives. We need to realize that both intrinsic and extrinsic motivations are important. The fire inside people is like a match. The way to ignite that flame is initially through friction. Then other matches are lit through warmth. I'm not big on giving a lot of psych-up speeches, even though I do believe in enthusiasm. I really like Ken Blanchard's teaching about catching people doing things right. They need to feel valued and appreciated, but they also need to feel that the work they are engaged in is worthy of their commitment and their best effort. Another question. In the world of the internet, where you can often escape from face-to-face, how do you optimize new technologies in a way that doesn't depersonalize the workplace, but still get the increased efficiencies that the new technologies can bring? My answer is, in my judgment, high-tech works in the long run only with high touch. Once you have a relationship, you can then think efficiently and operate efficiently. Technology enables you to be efficient, but it cannot take the place of the relationship. Remember, with people, fast is slow, and slow is fast. Technology, like the body, is a good servant, but a bad master. Chapter 10, Blending Voices, Searching for the Third Alternative. Warren Bennis wisely said, "Leaders do not avoid, repress, or deny conflict, but rather see it as an opportunity." I am personally convinced that one of the most difficult and challenging problems of life, whether at home, at work, or elsewhere, is how you deal with conflict, how you deal with human differences. Think about your challenges. Is this not so? What if you had the character and the skill to resolve differences synergistically, that is, to find solutions that are better than those anyone has proposed? The capacity and ability to produce such synergistic solutions, such creative cooperation, is built upon a foundation of moral authority at the personal level and trust in relationships. I once heard Gandhi's granddaughter, Arun Gandhi, share this penetrating insight about her grandfather. All in attendance at her speech were both humbled and electrified. This is the way she put it. Ironically, if it hadn't have been for racism and prejudice, we may not have had a Gandhi. He may have just been another successful lawyer who had made a lot of money. But because of prejudice in South Africa, he was subjected to humiliation within a week of his arrival. He was thrown off a train because of the color of his skin, and it humiliated him so much that he sat on the platform of the station all night, wondering what he could do to gain justice. His first response was one of anger. He was so angry that he wanted eye-for-eye justice. He wanted to respond violently to the people who humiliated him. But he stopped himself and said, "That's not right." It was not going to get him justice. It may have made him feel good for the moment, but it wasn't going to get him any justice. The second response was to want to go back to India and live among his own people in dignity. He ruled that out also. He said, "You can't run away from problems. You've got to stay and face the problems." And that's when the third response dawned on him, the response of nonviolent action. From that point onwards, he developed the philosophy of nonviolence and practiced it in his life as well as in his search for justice in South Africa. He ended up staying in that country for 22 years, and then he went and led the movement of India. Close quote. You see, the third alternative isn't my way. It isn't your way. It's our way. It's not a compromise halfway between your way and my way. It's better than a compromise. A third alternative is what the Buddhists call the middle way, a higher middle position that is better than either of the other two ways, like the tip of a triangle. The third alternative is a better alternative than any that have been proposed. It is a product of sheer creative effort. It emerges from the overlapping vulnerabilities of two or more people, from their openness, their willingness to really listen, their desire to search. You simply don't know where it's going to end up. All you know is that it's going to end up better than where it is now. The content may change. The spirit may change. The motive may change. Even two or three of these may change, and always at least one. As with Gandhi, the third alternative usually starts with oneself. But it often takes the force of circumstance, like some person opposing you, before it really begins to take place within you. Did you notice from the quote by Gandhi's granddaughter the interplay between his personal inward struggle and his interpersonal relationships? Gandhi had to do considerable personal work before he could deal with relationship challenges. New heading. It only takes one. The mindset of searching for the third alternative. Just as doing 20 push-ups is a physical analogy or metaphor for personal success, I would like to use another metaphor in my teaching to illustrate both the mindset and the skill set of searching for and achieving a true third alternative. I asked the audience to send a so-called volunteer who was very strong and over 6'3" to come up and take me on in an arm wrestle in front of the room. As the person is being coaxed and then is walking up, I start arrogantly telling the person to prepare to lose. I brag about my prowess, skill, strength, and black belt ranking. When they finally arrive up front, I tell them to repeat after me, "I am a loser," which most cooperate in doing. I tell this monster of a person that it's not a matter of size, it's a matter of technique, and that I have it and he doesn't. I become caustic and cutting. As intended, the audience's sympathies turn to my opponent. We get into the arm wrestle position with right foot against right foot and grab each other's hands in the middle. I then ask the table of people who volunteered my opponent if they would be willing to fund the contest. In other words, if he puts my arm down to the same level as our elbows, they would pay him $1. and if I put him down, then I would receive a dollar. They always agree. Then I ask somebody nearby to be the timer. They are to tell us when to start, give us about a minute to wrestle, count the times he puts me down or I put him down, and then get the people at the table from which the volunteer came to fund the whole deal, $1 for each put down. I then make sure the funding group feels their pockets are sufficiently deep to sustain this contest. They always agree. The timer tells us to begin. I immediately go limp, and he puts me down. Usually he's very surprised and puzzled that I didn't resist. He wonders what's going on. So we go back up to the top position. I let him put me down again, and perhaps again and again. All of the time he's expecting resistance. He usually starts feeling a little guilty, like he's being unfair. And then I simply say to him, "You know, what would really make us both feel good would be for both of us to win as much as possible." He's usually intrigued, but because I so attacked him, he doesn't know if he can trust me. Perhaps those are just nice words. What if my real plan is to flip or manipulate him in some way to my own advantage? But as I continue to let him win with no resistance, his conscience usually becomes my advocate, and he becomes open to my suggestion that if we both win, we'll both win more. Though begrudgingly, hesitatingly, and with some struggle, he is usually finally willing to let me win one. Then we go back to the center position, and then I let him win without any resistance. And within a few more seconds, he starts going back and forth without any resistance. Occasionally, some volunteer still is puzzled and wonder what's going on. They continue to resist, but eventually, it becomes a free-flowing, easy, and effortless program for us both. Next, I say, "Now, why don't we really get efficient?" Then we start moving our wrists back and forth, which is about 5 times faster than moving the whole arm. Then we use both arms and double the result. Finally, I say, "Now let's go over to your table and do it in front of their faces so that they can count the number of dollars they owe us." By this time, everyone is roaring and getting the message. I then explain to the audience that think-win-win, the mindset of searching for the third alternative, is the idea or principle of mutual respect and mutual benefit. In the arm wrestle, even though I was pretending to be stronger, better, and more aggressive in order to get my opponent into a win-lose mindset, I actually brought a win-win intention and mindset to the arm wrestle. Then right away I began seeking his interest, his win, without resistance. Once he became sufficiently humbled, open, and guilt-tripped, he then became receptive to the idea that we could both win more if we cooperated together. Then we became creative by first moving our wrists back and forth very rapidly, and then by bringing the other 2 hands together, moving them back and forth as well. The end result was truly a synergistic one, where both of us won a great deal. As for the table that had to fork up the reward money, they too won a great deal. Of learning. Of course, no real money was exchanged, but it's a very powerful, fun, and physical illustration of searching for and producing a third alternative. Can you see how I had to bring the inner strength and security of a 20 push-up capacity at the personal level to sustain my efforts to build trust and search for a third alternative? Because I had created within the other person's mind a deep competitive sense of win-lose, even to the point where he was inwardly saying, "There's no way this little bald pipsqueak is going to put me down." I had to patiently persist in the face of my opponent's understandably fierce response to my initial fake arrogance and personal attacks. Many people believe both people have to think win-win. Not so. Only one has to think it. Most people also believe that the other person must cooperate. But creative cooperation that produces third alternatives doesn't come until later, when you synergize. One simply has to first prepare the other by practicing empathy or deep listening, seeking his or her interest, and consistently staying with it until the other person feels trust, that they're not going to be used or manipulated or tricked. I did this on the Oprah show one time and had to go to great lengths to persuade the producer of the show to let me do it. The problem was that it had to be spontaneous, and no one would know the outcome, least of all Oprah herself. Between the loss of control and the reality of how each show has to stand up against rating standards, the producer felt very vulnerable and skeptical. But I continued to reassure her, and Oprah and I eventually went for it. While on the air, I similarly attacked and criticized her, told her of her weakness and my strength, and that she was going down. It really engaged her spirit, and she made up her mind to give it all she had. So she put me down fast and held me there. I said to her, "Oprah, why don't we both win?" She said, "No way." I said, "Why not?" She answered, "I was raised on the street. Anyone talked to me that way, no way I'd give in to them." "Fair enough, Oprah. Let's let you win again." Again, she said, "No way." There was no trust. I said, "Look, what we'll do is gradually come up to the center, then we'll go back on your side and you win another dollar, and I know how bad you need that." We had fun with it, and eventually, as did she, almost everyone learns the lesson. As the Far Eastern expression goes, one picture is worth a thousand words. I believe that one experience is worth a thousand pictures. The audience's picture of that arm wrestle is truly worth 10,000 words. And the participant's experience is worth 1,000 pictures. Perhaps you, as the reader, can envision it in your own mind. And if you want to see its power, just try it with one of your children, your spouse, or one of your associates. You see, most people won't go through the tough work of thinking win-win and seeking first to understand to get to the third alternative. This is evidenced by our research that only one-third of the XQ respondents agree that they work in a win-win environment, with win-win thinking. It requires a private victory. It requires considerable success at the personal level to get to the point where your security lies within you, rather than in people's opinions of you or in being right. The power lies in your ability to be vulnerable, because deep down, your integrity to your value system based on principles makes you invulnerable and secure. You can then afford to be open to influence and flexibility. You can afford to search, not knowing where you're going to end up, knowing only that it would be better than where you and the other person are starting from. New heading. The skill set of searching for the third alternative. Communication is without question the most important skill in life. There are basically four modes of communication: reading, writing, speaking, and listening. And most people spend two-thirds to three-fourths of their waking hours doing those four things. And of those four communication modes, the one that represents 40 to 50% of our communication time is listening, the one mode we have had the least training in. I mean, really, most of us have had years and years of training in reading, writing, and speaking, but no more than about 5% of us have had more than 2 weeks of formal training in how to listen. Most people think that they know how to listen because they're doing it all of the time. But really, they're listening from within their own frame of reference. Of the five levels of listening in what we might call the listening continuum, ignoring, pretend to listen, selective listening, attentive listening, and empathic listening, only the highest, empathic listening, is done within the frame of reference of the other person. To truly listen means to transcend your own autobiography, to get out of your frame of reference, out of your own value system, out of your own history and judging tendencies, and to get deeply into the frame of reference or viewpoint of another person. This is called empathic listening. It's a very, very rare skill. But it's much more than a skill, much more. Just reflect for a moment on these powerful words by Dr. Ralph Rofton. This is on listening. When I ask you to listen and you start giving advice, you have not done what I've asked. When I ask you to listen to me and you begin to tell me why I shouldn't feel that way, you are trampling on my feelings. When I ask you to listen and you feel you have to do something to solve my problem, you have failed me, strange as it may seem. Listen. All I ask was that you listen, not talk or do. Just hear me. I can do for myself. I'm not helpless. Maybe discouraged and faltering, but not helpless. When you do something for me that I can and need to do for myself, you contribute to my fear and feeling of inadequacy. But when you accept as fact that I do feel what I feel, no matter how irrational, then I can quit trying to convince you and can get about the business of understanding what's behind this irrational feeling. And when that's clear, the answers are obvious, and I don't need advice. Close quote. New heading, the Indian Talking Stick. After I trained Indian chiefs who head up Indian nations in the United States and Canada, the chiefs gave me a wonderful gift, a beautiful carved 5-foot-tall talking stick with the name Bald Eagle inscribed on it. The talking stick has played an integral part in Native American government for centuries. In fact, some of the founding fathers of the American Republic, particularly Benjamin Franklin, were educated in the ideas behind the talking stick by Indian chiefs of the Iroquois Federation. It is one of the most powerful communication tools I've ever seen, because while it's tangible and physical, it embodies a concept that is powerfully synergistic. This talking stick represents how people with differences can come to understand one another through mutual respect, which then enables them to solve their differences and problems synergistically, or at the very least, through compromise. Here's the theory behind it. Whenever people meet together, the talking stick is present. Only the person holding the talking stick is permitted to speak. As long as you have the talking stick, you alone may speak until you are satisfied that you are understood. Others are not permitted to make their own points, to argue, agree, or disagree. All they may do is attempt to understand you, and then articulate that understanding. They may need to restate your point to make sure you feel understood, or you may simply feel that they do understand. They might ask questions regarding the level of their understanding, but their whole focus is to understand you. Then, as soon as you feel understood, it is your obligation to pass the talking stick to the next person, and then to work to make him feel understood. As he makes his points, you have to listen, restate, and empathize until he truly feels understood. This way, all of the parties involved take responsibility for 100% of the communication, both speaking and listening. Once each of the parties feels understood, an amazing thing usually happens. Negative energy dissipates, contention evaporates, mutual respect grows, and people become positive and creative. New ideas emerge, third alternatives appear. Remember, to understand does not mean to agree with. It just means to be able to see with the other person's eyes, heart, mind, and spirit. One of the deepest needs of the human soul is to be understood. Once that need is met, the personal focus can shift to interdependent problem solving. But if that very intense need for understanding is not met, ego battles take place, turf issues arise, defensive and protective communication is the order of the day. Sometimes contention, even violence, can erupt. The human need to feel understood is like the lungs' need for air. If all the air were suddenly sucked out of the room that you're in, how motivated would you be to get air? Would you be interested in having a discussion or working out some difference between you and somebody else? Of course not. You just want one thing. You'd be open to other things only after you've got air. Feeling understood is the equivalent of psychological air. The same process we've been discussing can take place in people's minds without a talking stick, though it doesn't necessarily provide the same tangible discipline of clearly transferring the responsibility to speak with courage and then listen with empathy. There's a tremendous focus of attention and personal interest when you actually have a physical stick. You don't need an actual talking stick. You could use a pencil, a spoon, or a piece of chalk, any tangible thing that physically places the responsibility upon the speaker. to pass it only when he feels understood, and not until he does. Have you ever sat in a meeting where you could just feel the hidden agendas operating? Think of the power of inserting the idea of the talking stick into such a meeting. If using the actual stick or pencil seems inappropriate, then express the basic underlying concept or idea. Simply speak up at the beginning of the meeting before people become emotionally invested in the jugular issues. And even if you're not the chair of the meeting, just say something like this. We're going to be talking about a lot of important things today that people have strong feelings about. To help us in our communication, why don't we agree that no one can make his or her point until they restate the last person's point to his or her satisfaction? Even though this statement doesn't introduce the physical talking stick, it does introduce the essence of the idea, because no one can make his or her point until the other can say, "I feel understood." Many may hesitate to buy into this process because it seems a little pedestrian, even childish and inefficient. But I'll guarantee you, it's just the opposite. It requires such self-control and draws such maturity into the communication that even though it may seem inefficient at first, it becomes highly effective. That is, it achieves the desired results in terms of both synergistic decisions and synergistic relationships, bonding, and trust. Here's how a meeting might go with you as the facilitator of the Indian talking stick concept. Sylvia and Roger are in a meeting. Right in the middle of Sylvia's efforts to explain her point, Roger says something like, "I disagree with Sylvia. I think what we should do is..." You interrupt and say, "Excuse me, Roger. Remember what we agreed upon to help us in our communication?" Roger replies, "Oh yeah, I'm supposed to make Sylvia's point first. Then I can make mine." You answer, "No, Roger. You don't make Sylvia's point. You make Sylvia's point to her satisfaction. Then you can make your own." "Oh, yeah, that's right," he responds. "What was Sylvia's point, Roger?" He attempts to make it. "Is that correct, Sylvia?" "No, not at all. What I'm trying to say is..." Roger interrupts again. "Again now, Roger, what's our ground rule?" "Oh, yeah, I'm supposed to make Sylvia's point to her satisfaction." So for the first time, he struggles to listen more deeply and essentially mimics her. "How was that, Sylvia?" you ask. She responds, "Well, he mimicked me, but he didn't get the spirit of my point at all." "Sorry, Roger. Try again." "When's it my time?" he says. "I've been up with my staff 2 nights preparing for this meeting." Remember the ground rule, Roger? There's no admission to this arena without the ticket of the other person saying that you understand their point. So he is torn between his ego needs, his hidden agendas, his desire to speak, and the realization that he is not a player until he first understands to the other's satisfaction. So for the first time, he really listens empathically. Sylvia says, "Thank you, Roger. I do feel understood." "Okay, Roger, your turn." Roger looks and says, "I agree with Sylvia." My experience is that if people really try to understand each other, they will, in most but not all cases, come to agree with each other. Why? Because over 90% of all communication problems are caused by differences in either semantics or perceptions. Again, semantics means the way you define words or terms. Perception means how you interpret data. Whenever people listen to each other with true empathy, that is, within the other's frame of reference, both semantic and perceptual problems dissolve. That is because they're listening from within the other's frame of reference. They're sensing how the other defines words and terms, and how the other interprets meaning and data. This puts them on the same song sheet, using the same language, which then enables them to get on with problem solving on the other 10% of the genuine disagreements. The spirit of this mutual understanding is so affirming, so healing, so bonding, that when people do discuss their disagreements, they do it in agreeable ways and are usually able to solve them either through synergy or a form of compromise. And if they have had this experience, they are so bonded, they will not be disloyal to each other behind each other's back. it would violate their integrity too much. Silence is also a key to Indian talking stick communication with others. We must be quiet, even silent, to begin to deeply empathize with others. Of the power of this silence, Robert Greenleaf commented, "One must not be afraid of a little silence. Some find silence awkward or oppressive, but a relaxed approach to dialogue will include the welcoming of some silence. It is often a devastating question to ask oneself, but it is sometimes important to ask it. In saying what I have in mind, will I really improve on the silence?" On a lighter note, let me share a story I heard recently that shows the effects of a person who does not understand or practice the Indian talking stick concept. A farmer went into the attorney's office wanting to file for divorce from his wife. The attorney asked, "May I help you?" To which the farmer replied, "Yeah, I want to get one of those divorces." The attorney said, "Well, do you have any grounds?" And the farmer said, "Yeah, I got about 140 acres. The attorney said, "No, you don't understand. Do you have a case?" And the farmer replied, "No, I don't have a case, but I have a John Deere." And the attorney said, "No, you really don't understand. I mean, do you have a grudge?" And the farmer replied to that, "Yeah, I got a grudge. That's where I park my John Deere." The attorney, still trying, asked, "No, sir, I mean, do you have a suit?" The farmer replied, "Yes, sir, I got a suit. I wear it to church on Sundays." The exasperated and frustrated attorney said, "Well, sir, does your wife beat you up or anything?" The farmer replied, "No, sir, we both get up about 4:30. Finally, the attorney says, "Okay, let me put it this way. Why do you want a divorce?" And the farmer says, "Well, I never have a meaningful conversation with her." New heading: The Two Steps to Searching for a Third Alternative. There are basically two steps in searching for a third alternative. In fact, the very searching process through these two steps feeds back and helps create the trust, that is the moral authority, that encourages the search. The first step would be simply to say to the other person, "Would you be willing to search for a solution that is better than what either one of us have proposed?" The second step, would you agree to a simple ground rule? No one can make his or her point until they have restated the other person's point to his or her satisfaction. Now let's say you're a third party that are helping to bring together two other people. Just say, first step, would you be willing to search for a solution that is better than what either one of you have proposed? And then go to the simple ground rule and get them to agree that no one can make his or her point until they have restated the other person's point to his or her satisfaction. That, in a sense, is the Indian talking stick ground rule. It's important to note that these two steps are not always sequential. At times, you start with the first one. Other times, you start with the second one. Sometimes, you may just naturally begin interacting and genuinely trying to listen to someone else who has a totally different point of view and solution. Then you might ask the other to listen to you as you have to them, after which you might see if the other wants to search for a third alternative. Sometimes you find yourself going back and forth between these two steps. Every situation is different, and every relationship is very unique. Bottom line, it requires good judgment, awareness, self-control, and presence to initiate these two steps. New heading: Experiences in Searching for the Third Alternative. Over the years, some of my most challenging but enjoyable professional experiences have come from acting as a third-party facilitator in taking people who were very emotionally invested in strong opposition to each other, almost to the point of irrationality, through the two steps of searching for and finding a synergistic third alternative. You can literally see them struggle through the modes of communication reflected in the continuum at the bottom of hostility, then defensive communication, and then compromise communication, and then third alternative communication. Defensive communication and hostility basically is contentious and just breeds more negative energy. Compromise communication is essentially a transaction. But third alternative synergistic communication, where 1 + 1 can equal 100, is really transformation. It changes both parties. It changes the whole nature of the relationship. One of my very first experiences took place when our firm needed to film a genuine, real-life, spontaneous experience that taught synergy for a product we were creating. So I decided to use one of my live seminars. I chose a highly charged subject, the environment, and invited two people in the audience to come up and join me on the stage. A woman who was a strong, convinced, passionate environmentalist, a real greener, and a strong, convinced, passionate businessman who uses natural resources for economic purposes in his business. They never even shook hands. Even professional boxers touch gloves. She even attacked him on her way up to the stage, saying, "It's your ilk that has messed up our air, our water, and our kids' futures." Then he looked at her shoes and said, "Nice shoes. Are they leather?" She looked down and then back at him and responded, "What's that got to do with it?" He retorted, "I just wonder what animal you killed." She answered, "I don't kill animals." He responded, "Oh, you had others do the killing for you." That was the beginning of the communication. And you saw it even in their body language. 45 minutes later, after going slowly and patiently through the two steps, they both ended up arguing for sustainable development policies at both the corporate and the government levels. The audience was totally amazed. Whenever you teach the first step, would you be willing to search for a solution that is better than what either one of you have brought to the table? People inevitably say, as did these two, "I don't know what it would be," or "I've spent years on this matter and I have strong convictions." So you acknowledge, that's right. No one knows what it will be. It has to be created together. The question is, would you be willing to search for such a solution? They usually respond, "I will not compromise." You answer, "Of course not. Synergy is not compromise. It must be a better solution, and you must know it. The other must know it. And you both must know that you both know it. There is no compromise." In other words, you are seeking for the good of both. You are not just advocating your own case. They often respond, "But I don't know where we go from here." You go to step two, that no one can make his or her point until they restate the other person's point to his or her satisfaction. Now I'll tell you, that is the test. It is tremendously challenging for people who have endlessly argued for one position to genuinely listen to another person. Because unless they listen to another person and restate his or her point to his or her satisfaction, they can't make their point. It's the ticket of admission. I did this once at a university setting on the subject of abortion, bringing a pro-life person and a pro-choice person up front. Both felt morally committed to their positions. I took them slowly and patiently through the two steps in front of over 400 people, including an entire MBA class and many faculty and invited guests. Again, after about 40 minutes of going through the two steps slowly, they both began to talk about prevention, adoption, and education. The whole nature of the discussion had changed. The audience was literally mesmerized. Tears filled the two participants' eyes. I asked them why this was so emotional. It wasn't because of the issue at all. It was simply because they were ashamed of the way they had categorically judged and condemned and stereotyped, even demonized, everyone who thought differently on this issue. By listening genuinely and deeply, they came to realize, this is a good person. I like this person. I respect this person. I don't agree with this person's opinions. But I am willing to listen. I am open. I'll tell you, to watch minds become open and hearts become softened and positions melt into a higher synergistic third alternative is really a thrilling experience. These two steps don't always work simply because people won't always apply them. I was once in Washington with the Young President's Organization teaching this material, and I invited the president of the National Education Association, the NEA, and the head person behind the voucher movement in California to come up and go through the two steps. Begrudgingly, they went through the first one, both saying that they had no idea what they would find in the search and that they would not compromise. When it came to the second step of having to restate to the other's satisfaction, they attempted, and then they caved in. They became very defensive and then literally became hostile, calling one another names, including describing each other's parents. The audience literally dismissed them. They were their invited guests, and they were dismissed because they failed to serve the purpose of the conference. Then the audience became synergistic. These were parents who genuinely cared, who were aware that it was a very complex issue, and that you couldn't make sweeping generalizations, and that you needed to have a deeper understanding. The audience became more and more creative about how to strengthen the education system, including the degree to which the market could be brought into education in some settings, and what to do in those settings where it would be very difficult and even perhaps counterproductive. I have done this many, many times on all kinds of business issues. Frequently, I ask my clients, what issue seems to divide your culture? One that's almost non-discussable. Usually they are hesitant, but eventually they come forth with it. I ask them, would you be willing to allow me to use that as an example in producing synergy, a third alternative? Oh, they usually respond, oh, it's too tender, too difficult. I don't know how it could possibly be done. I explain the process and the two steps. Then I assure them that if there is enough sincerity and moral authority in the group, which expects sincerity and genuine effort toward practicing the two points, it would give them one of the most powerful experiences their organization could ever have. Not only in solving the issue, but also, even more importantly, in developing an immune system inside the culture that would enable them to do the same thing on any issue that comes along. Once I was with a group of healthcare professionals that included trustees, executives, administrators, and many of the physicians. The issue to be debated, one that they had fought over for many months, was the use of outside physicians. The medical director was the spokesman for one side, the CEO for the other. In front of about 100 people, I took them slowly through the two steps. They produced a third alternative that both were absolutely enthusiastic about, not just because they liked it better than the present arrangement or what either had proposed, but also because it was so healing and bonding to their relationship. Another time I was working with a group of insurance people in Cancun, Mexico, at one of their big international conferences. I was asked to speak on cultural transformation through principle-centered leadership. After sensing the mood of the groups, how artificial their communication on substantive issues was, how polarized the front office was from the general managers in the field, and the general managers were from the producing agents, I decided to bag my prepared speech. Instead, I decided to help them see how serious this cultural malaise was, and the impact it was having on their business and their customers. So I simply took one question, who owns the customer? And had two people from each of the three groups headquarters people, general managers, and producing agents. Come up in front of the entire assembly. Each in turn gave the reasons why they own the customer. The producing agents claimed that they found the customer, had the relationship, and sold the customer. The general manager looked with disdain on that reasoning and said, "We are the ones who have to service these people over time. You can walk. We can't. We have to stay and represent our products and the fulfillment of our promises." The headquarters executives looked with disdain upon both groups, saying essentially, "You people are clueless. Who developed the products? Who fulfills on the products? Who has set up the whole institutionalized system to make our business run?" Thereafter, it became obvious to everybody how sick the culture had become, how dichotomized, how split. No one group owned the customer, but the customer owned himself or herself. And that unless they got their act together, they would not be able to get and keep customers. Not over time. The experience was humbling to them and made them very open to going through the two steps of producing a synergistic third alternative. One time I received a phone call from the president of a company to ask if I would help resolve a very costly, protracted lawsuit with a major client customer. The client was suing the company for lack of performance against their understanding of agreed-upon criteria. I knew this president well. He had been trained in the material I teach, but felt a lack of confidence in his ability to apply it. I assured him he did not need me. He could do it by himself. So I slowly retaught the material to him over the phone and got him to read the material I had given him earlier. He was very hesitant and fearful. But after my reaffirming him very strongly, he agreed to do it on his own. He called up the president of the suing company and suggested that they meet for lunch. The other president said, "There's no need. Let's let the legal process carry itself out," probably thinking that the calling president was ready to settle, compromise, or play softball. He decided to stick to his hardball tactics and turn down the luncheon invitation. So my friend told him what he was trying to do and why. He told him about the two steps and also told him that, though he would not have his own attorney come, he, the other president, could bring his attorney and say nothing if the attorney counseled him not to. This way, he would avoid the risk of compromising himself in some way in the court of law. He again said, "What have you got to lose? An hour or two? It has already cost our companies many tens of thousands of dollars, and we're just beginning the process." On that basis, the other president agreed to meet and to bring his attorney. With the three of them in the room and two flip charts, my friend said, "First, I want to see if I understand your position in this suit." And he restated it as completely and fully as he possibly could. After a few minutes, he said, "Do you feel I have a correct understanding? Has this been correct and fair?" The other president said, "Yes, except for 2 points." His attorney interrupted him and suggested he say no more. But this president, sensing that there was genuine movement here and true sincerity in a very powerful two-step effort, basically told his attorney to shut up, and he opened up these 2 points. My friend wrote them down on the flip chart, and again he asked, "Do you feel like I understand? Is there anything else you want me to understand? Has anything been omitted?" The other president said, "No, I feel you understand." And then my friend said, "Could I ask you to listen to me as I have attempted to listen to you? Would that be fair?" What essentially happened was that the first point, that is, searching for the third alternative, emerged through their attempting to understand each other. The motivation to solve the problem emerged. And not only did they settle in a way that deeply satisfied both of them, but they also continued their relationship. Their remaining struggle was to figure out how they were going to communicate their desire to continue this business relationship to two cultures that had coalesced around their fight and opposition with one another. The main point is that people can do this on their own. They don't need a third-party facilitator. It takes the ability to be a participant and an observer, or a third-party facilitator at the same time. This takes a lot of mental and emotional discipline, but if you have faith in the principles and sufficient internal courage and integrity, in short, moral authority, you can do it. Sometimes the nature of a third alternative may appear to be a compromise, that one or both gave in a little. But this isn't necessarily so. It could be that the key thing had not been the issue at all. What became the most important element was the quality of the relationship, the depth of the understanding, or the alteration of the motivation. I remember a colleague once sharing with me the story of his father and mother. It beautifully illustrates this point. Here are his words. My father had been a superb dentist for 30 years when he was diagnosed with amyloidosis, a rare disease similar to cancer. The doctors gave him 6 months to live. Because of the effects of the disease, he had to give up his practice. So here sits this man who had always been extremely active, with nothing to do all day except think about his fatal disease. He decided he wanted to take his mind off things by putting a greenhouse in the backyard where he could grow his favorite plants. This wouldn't be a fancy glass greenhouse that you see behind Victorian mansions. This would be one of those kit greenhouses complete with corrugated plastic for a roof and black plastic sides. My mother didn't want that monstrosity.